The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Sean Martin, and I'm the board chair of the Raven Society, the Free Library's Young Supporters Group. If you're in your 20s or 30s and are passionate about literacy and the library, we would love to have you as a member. Check out the table outside the auditorium for information on joining the Raven Society. Please refrain from taking pictures during our program tonight. And before you silence and put away your cell phones, take a moment to show the Free Library a little love. Text LOVE FLP to the number 20222 to donate $10 to our materials fund. Your gift will help us fill the library with the resources you use and enjoy the most, from ebooks to DVDs to children's picture books. Again, that's LOVE FLP to the number 20222. Tonight, I have the honor of introducing two accomplished authors, Jonathan Safran Foer and Nathan Englander. Foer's debut novel, Everything is Illuminated, which he wrote at age 25, won a National Jewish Book Award and a Guardian First Book Award. His New York Times best-selling novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, was made into an Oscar-nominated motion picture. Nathan Englander is author of The Ministry of Special Cases and For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, which earned a Penn Malamud Award and the American Academy of Arts and Letters Sue Kaufman Prize. Together, Foer and Englander provide a new way of experiencing the Haggadah, the recounting of the story of Exodus through prayer and song, read each year around the Seder table. Foer's fresh understanding of the sacred text and Englander's new translation, along with provocative commentary by a collection of major Jewish writers and thinkers, offer a bold and contemporary option to read at Passover. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to have them here tonight. Please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Jonathan Safran Foer.
Hi, thank you. So this is the first event that we have done for this book, and that feels fitting, at least in my life, because I had my first ever proper author event, actually, at the Philadelphia Free Library. This was about 10 or 11, 12 even years ago. So I have a very strong sentimental attachment. So I don't know what the makeup of this audience is. And given that it's the first event that I've done for this book, I don't know if this will be representative of future audiences or not. And so I have some unease about how much I'm supposed to explain or how much I'm supposed to take for granted. I'm going to actually take very, very little for granted. In New York, you know, basically everybody is basically Jewish. Just yesterday, I heard Yiddish wafting down a subway car in which there were no white people. So the culture has obviously permeated the city. A couple of years ago, 2 years ago, I decided that it would be an interesting idea to make a sukkah, because I had a kid who was just coming into that kind of consciousness, and I thought I could, I don't know, demonstrate or even prove something to both of us by doing this. And so I went to you need to put this material over the top that is of an organic matter through which you can see the stars, but which provides some shelter. And so I thought, where am I going to get this? And so I went to Crown Heights, to a religious neighborhood, and I started asking around after it, and everybody was pretending they didn't know what I meant. And then I went to just a garden supply store, actually, sort of deeper in Brooklyn. And I was talking to this Haitian guy, a recent immigrant, as it turned out. And I said, I'm looking for something sort of like bamboo, maybe, or kind of like long sticks. And it's got to be kind of more than 4 feet long, but not really any less than 8 feet long. And it should support itself, but doesn't really need to support anything over it. And he said, are you looking for shach? I said, that's exactly what I'm looking for. So I recently went to England to speak about this book. It was a little bit of a lie when I said this is the first event I've done at all, because I did talk about it in England. And when I got to the airport, I was accosted by one of the immigration officials. I don't know why, but it happens to me every single time I go there. And I've now become familiar enough with the drill that I just try to answer questions in a way that will facilitate my passage. And he looked at my form and he said, so you're here for work. What kind of work are you here for? And I said, I'm here to talk about a book. I thought that was a very simple way to answer that. And he said, is it a book that you wrote, a book of yours? And I said, well, you know, not really. It wouldn't be right to say yes. No, it's not really a book that I wrote. And he said, really? So it's not really a book that you wrote. Well, is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? And I said, you know, it's not, in as many words, fiction. It's not really nonfiction. And he said, well, what kind of book is it? And I said, do you know what a Haggadah is? And he said, no. And I said, do you know what Passover is? And he said, no. I've never heard of that. In England, you know, in New York, I said even the Gentiles are basically Jewish. In England, even the Jews are basically Gentiles. And this was not even a Jew. So he obviously let me pass, or I wouldn't be here right now. But his exchange reminded me of what an incredibly difficult book the Haggadah is to describe, because it's not a work of fiction, and it's not a work of nonfiction. It's not exactly a prayer book. It's not exactly a work of history or philosophy. It's sort of a user's manual. It's sort of a timeline. It's sort of a work of poetry. And it's sort of an ethical argument. And it's sort of a palimpsest. But it's not really any of those things. Or it's not exclusively any of those things. So Jews have a very special relationship to books. And the Haggadah has been translated more widely, more times, reprinted more often than any other Jewish book. It's been said that there are 7,000 versions. 7,000 versions have been created. They're no longer, of course, 7,000 in existence. Everywhere that there have been Jews, and whenever there have been Jews, there have always been Haggadahs. The Torah is the foundational text for Jewish law, but the Haggadah is our book of living memory. And what's so interesting about it, and what I found so appealing about it, and what I've grown to love most about it, is that it doesn't only tell a story, even though it does tell what is probably or arguably the oldest continuously told story and arguably the most widely known story across cultures. It doesn't merely tell a story. It demands this radical act of empathy. So I would say it's even the most profound demand that any book of any kind ever published makes. And what it asks is not that we be recipients of the story, but that we be characters within the story. We are supposed to feel as if we ourselves are being liberated from Egypt while we read this book. Thousands of years later, and half a world away, ink on paper is supposed to inspire this amazing leap. So to take a step back, for those of you who don't know what a Haggadah is, Passover is the most widely celebrated Jewish holiday, and by a long shot. The Seder, which is the festival dinner, which occurs on consecutive nights, in the spring is the annual retelling of the Exodus from Egypt. Seder means order in Hebrew, and to follow this established order, which includes prayers and also songs and all kinds of ritualistic activity, families rely on this book, the Haggadah. Most simply described, and this is really how I should have described it at the airport, it's the user's manual for the holiday. And you can't celebrate Passover without one. So for as long as I've been alive, my parents have hosted the first night's Seder at our house, and my grandparents the second night. As our family matured and expanded, and as the Seder became more inclusive, growing to include just about anyone, really, who wanted to come, but certainly cousins, grandparents, aunts, uncles, our teachers from school, if friends or family were visiting, if we had, Gentile friends who were just interested. We had to move the Seder to our basement. And what had been held at the dining room table came to be held at about 12 tables pushed together, some of which really weren't tables at all. I remember, I always knew it was Passover when my dad would ask me to take the net off the ping pong table because we were going to line it up with the bumper pool table and the card tables and the tables that someone had to run out to Home Depot to buy that afternoon. At the second Seder, we would use the Maxwell House Haggadah, which I will get to later. At the first Seder, at my parents' house, we used a Haggadah that my father cobbled together. He would make new additions every couple of years, and he would Xerox things from other books, basically. And when more recently, he would download things from the internet. And the joke in the family was, why is this night different from all other nights? Because on this night, copyright doesn't apply. So at my grandparents', we would use the Maxwell House. So people laughed when I mentioned it, but probably it was a nervous laugh because you probably use it too. Since 1934, Maxwell House, as in the coffee company, has been the most used Haggadah in the world. It's distributed for free. And there are somewhere north of 45 million of them in print. And they're exactly as inspired as you would imagine them to be. Fortunately, there are another, as I said before, about 7,000 Haggadot in the world. And some of them are quite utilitarian, and some of them are quite inspired, artistically, intellectually. Some of them have rather severe political agendas overlaid onto them, like a vegetarian Haggadah or a transgender Haggadah, whatever it is. And others are more straightforward tellings of the story. So in 34 years of attending these two Seders, I've now been to, 68 Seders in my life, I never found a satisfying Haggadah. I never found one that I would consider a great book by the standards that I use to judge secular books. When we would say this Haggadah is very nice looking, what we meant is, relative to other Haggadot, this is nice looking. Or when we would say the writing is really good here, don't you think? What we meant was relative to other Haggadot, as opposed to relative to the very best writing that we would read in the course of the rest of the year, or the things that most pleased us to look at in art galleries and museums. And there's just simply no reason that a Haggadah shouldn't surpass that writing and that art. Because of the dramatic story that it tells and because of the questions that it raises and inspires, it should be a great book. It has all of the material to be a great book. It lends itself more than any other book I can think of to creativity and thought. But more than that, much more importantly, because of the themes that it explores, slavery and the perpetual movement toward freedom, and also because its audience is so unusually large and captive, in the very best sense. It's not very often that, in fact, I can't think of another time, really, that families gather to talk about the very, very big themes in life, to take stock in, who we are and how close we are to who we wanted to be. The book really, really ought to be good. It ought to be clear. It ought to be functioning. It ought to exhilarate us. The Seder is a protest against despair. The universe might appear deaf to our fears and hopes, but we are not. So we gather and we share them and we pass them down. We've been waiting for the moment, for this metaphorical Jerusalem of next year, for thousands of years. More than 100 generations of Jews have actually sat at Seder tables and read a Haggadah, and will continue to wait. But I thought, what is this waiting supposed to look like? Is it supposed to be an idle waiting or an active and creative waiting? So almost exactly 9 years ago, after actually the Seder at my grandparents' house, when we used this Maxwell House promotional device, I thought it might be interesting to work on a Haggadah. It's not a radical idea. As I said, Jews everywhere have been doing it always, and it is the most revisited book of any kind. I had no idea when I was beginning how the project would end. I only knew that my ambition was to make something that was more engaging, something that would stimulate really significant conversations, something that could tell a story, an ancient story, by the standards we use to judge secular books, that we use to judge our favorite works of literature and our favorite works of art, and most ambitiously, a Haggadah that might inspire that radical leap of empathy, that might for a moment make somebody feel like he or she was re-experiencing the story instead of moving through it by rote. So I thought in the beginning that it would just be a matter of gathering really good writers and artists. I thought if you put that together, the recipe is going to be a very good Haggadah. So I wrote to thinkers that I most admired, people like Tony Kushner, Simon Sharma, Cynthia Ozick, Oliver Sacks, David Remnick, and all of them said yes. Not all of them right away, but all of them said yes. There's often a little bit of skepticism, a little bit of wariness, hesitancy, but as the conversation moved into its third or fourth exchange, the skepticism always, always gave way to curiosity and ultimately eagerness. And I thought that I would share with you the first response that Susan Sontag sent me when I invited her to participate in this. And it's just utterly charming and in certain ways very well illustrates, I think, the mental process that a certain kind of Jew goes through when approaching a certain kind of ritualistic document. She said, "As for the Haggadah, Jonathan dear, I think I'll pass. It's a wonderful idea, and I wish you every success with it, but I have no Jewish background and have never celebrated Pesach." Of course, she said Pesach and not Passover. Of course, that doesn't mean that I don't think that I'm Jewish. I do. And I like being some kind of Jew, the 100% secular kind. Still, I don't really like tribes. Let's say I'm very cross-tribal. Indeed, with all the dreadful crimes being committed in the name of religion, religion as such has started to give me the creeps. These days, I'm feeling 200% secular. So I'd probably have to be a little cranky if I agreed to embroider my way on the Haggadah. And what would be the point of that? I know this isn't an argument, and maybe you might even be able to talk me out of it or into it. So I responded with a lengthy note explaining not only why I thought the Haggadah was an important book, but why I thought her contribution would be important, and more, why her natural questioning would be a huge asset to this book that is a book of questions more than anything else. I told her what I told Nathan, who's going to speak in a second, who contributed this unbelievable translation to this book. I said, "This is a book that I'm sure we'll be proud of if we work on it hard enough and long enough." And she wrote back simply, "Okay." Unfortunately, by the time the book took its form, and that was still another 4 or 5 years from that email, it was really too late for her to participate. So as I said, I had no idea what the structure of this book was going to be, or what exactly each contributor would do. So it ended up growing very organically and very stupidly, unfortunately. At one point, the book had almost 30 contributing writers and artists. The pieces were absolutely phenomenal, really, really fine writing and fine art. But I was accidentally creating an anthology or an interesting reference book, and I wasn't creating a functioning Haggadah. So I very dramatically reinvented or reconceived of the form by collapsing the book all the way back down to the new translation, which I always knew would be the heart of the book. The liturgy comprises the great, great bulk of the book and is the most important part of the book. A new design, which I'll talk about in a second, and only 4 contributing voices that would work throughout. So this wasn't at all what I had originally envisioned, but it worked. Unfortunately, an enormous amount of time was spent getting to this conclusion, and only about 10% of the material that people sent in was actually used. In fact, I killed virtually all of my own writing in the process. In the end, the kill fees for this book were greater than the fees for work that was included in the book, which I can't explain why, but I'm sure is also Jewish in its own way. But ultimately what I realized and what this process came down to is that a Haggadah is not an act of self-expression. It's an act of Haggadah expression. And I'd made a mistake in the beginning in the way that I conceived of it. And there's probably a kind of hubris behind that mistake. But I'm very grateful that that was corrected. I realized that the most that we could possibly hope for was just to tune this really fine instrument in such a way that it would be more easy for people to sing along to. So before giving up the stage to Nathan, I want to say just a couple of words about what distinguishes this Haganah. So most importantly, as I said, is Nathan's translation. It is careful and clear. It's really radically different without being in any way radical. I think it's far better than any translation I've ever read. It captures the lyricism and the moral force of the liturgy by conveying it as literally as possible, but also recognizing that sometimes to convey something literally, you have to invent. And I think he strikes a very, very beautiful balance in doing so. And the book is new to the world, but it's been getting a lot of responses so far, as you can imagine, because of the kinds of people who are drawn to a Haggadah. They're people who naturally respond. And Nathan's translation has been receiving uniform, like really, really glowing excitement. This is the only visually embellished Haggadah that I know of, whose design is entirely text-based. There's absolutely no figurative artwork. If you open the Maxwell House, you see a picture of a kid who I suspect isn't even Jewish, by the way, holding up a Kiddush cup. This doesn't contribute anything. It only wastes ink and paper, as far as I'm concerned. So we tried something very different. And it's very attractive. I think if you open the book, you will say this is a really nice-looking book. But more than attractive, it adds a layer of meaning. It contextualizes the book. What Oded Ezer, he's an Israeli typographer who I learned about because some of his work was in a show at MoMA. He created a document that is a record, actually, of Hebrew lettering throughout time. So what he did was there's a timeline that runs graphically across the top of the book, which sort of tells the story of the Exodus and of Seders, how the Passover story has appeared throughout Jewish history and throughout world history. So what he did, which is really ingenious, is he looked at the dates at the top of each page, and he researched what did Hebrew lettering look like at that period in time. How were Jews writing? How were Jews printing when printing was practiced? And his design used that typography as an inspiration. So, you know, part of the decision in not using any figurative art was to withhold any heavy-handed artistic sensibility. And this guided a lot of the process. I didn't want to have the Maurice Sendak Haggadah. One of the greatest Haggadahs ever made is the Ben Shahn Haggadah. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's absolutely radiant, but it's the Ben Shahn Haggadah. That's all it is. It is the Ben Shahn Haggadah. It is not the Haggadah Ben Shahn. And I think it's a real risk and a real danger. So in the interest of sort of suppressing a sensibility while at the same time creating something that's really beautiful and engaging, Oded came up with the solution of just leading with words, which makes so much sense. You know, this is the most literary book of the most literary people, as far as I'm concerned. And he dealt with it in a very literary way. The commentaries, I mentioned the timeline probably enough for now. The commentaries are very new. We have four different perspectives commenting on what are sort of the 10, I don't know, most important, the 10 moments when most families want to pause and say, what's going on here? You can guess what most of them are. You know, the plagues, the Afikomen, Haggadah, the four sons, really the looking up and taking a breath moments in the Seder. So we have four different perspectives. One is called Nation, and it's written by Jeffrey Goldberg. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic, for The New Yorker. You might have read he had a very long interview with Obama about Iran about a week ago. And he asks, what are the political questions we should be grappling with as a people, as a nation? Then there's a commentary that we call Library, which is written by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. She's a novelist and a philosopher. And it approaches the Haggadah from a kind of literary psychological perspective. You know, what's going on in the story right now? Why are these characters acting in the ways that they are? What are their motives? What are their desires? Are they acting in a way that we should take a positive lesson from? Are they acting in a way that we should be critical of? The third voice is called House of Study by Nathaniel Deutsch. He's a Jewish scholar. His grandfather actually wrote, apparently, one of the most famous Haggadot ever made in Hungary. And he practices more of a traditional rabbinic kind of questioning, referencing, you know, the stream of Jewish commentary through the ages. And finally, there's one called Playground by Lemony Snicket. And it is written for younger readers. The idea was to make sure that there was something engaging in this book, some way to use it for the younger people at the table. After all, more than anything else, I think it's a celebration of the transmission of certain values. And those values are being transmitted to the youngest people at the table. A lot of the ritual is addressed to or for the benefit of the youngest people at the table. So it felt highly appropriate to have a voice for them. And Lemony Snicket is the person who seems to capture their imagination better than anyone who isn't an English woman. So, the idea was not just that the commentaries could be used differently by different people at the table, but that they would reveal what an incredibly rich document this is and how the more you push into it, the more it gives back. More than anything, though, I think what distinguishes this Haggadah is the room that it makes for readers. As I said earlier, Haggadah really shouldn't just be read. It has to be felt. It has to inspire a user to feel really that he or she is a character in this story, that this is a story that is not yet complete. The worst mistake that a Haggadah could make is to have an overt sensibility that forbids entry. And the very best thing that a Haggadah could do is to inspire. So just finally, I want to say a word about how I approach this. I'm not an observant Jew, or not a very observant Jew. And I wouldn't be considered religious by probably most people's definitions. But this oldest of rituals, which conveys the oldest of stories, feels very contemporary to me and very important to me. And I would say especially now that I'm a father. And religion really snuck up on me as a parent. Throughout my childhood, I spent Sunday mornings and Wednesday afternoons promising my future children that they would never waste their Sunday mornings and Wednesday afternoons at Hebrew school. And yet, when the time comes, and we're still a couple years away, it's actually very hard to imagine anything different than what my parents did, making choices that are different than their choices, or the choices of their parents, or the choices of their parents, 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 parents. Traditions of all kinds direct and compel parental choices. So this is true for everything from the kinds of breakfasts that I cook my children to the kinds of stories that I read to them when putting them to bed. But so does the desire to get it slightly more right, to put lessons learned in my own life to use, to try to shape traditions to fit our lives and our moment. So we're raising our children as vegetarians, and we often invent our own stories to tell them when we put them to bed. And it's a real balancing act. How do you bind yourself to the old without binding yourself? The need for new Haggadahs doesn't imply a failure of existing ones, but the struggle to be bound without being bound, to engage everyone at the table in an ancient story in a time that's unlike any time that came before it. So our translation has to know our idiom, our commentaries have to wrestle with our conflicts, and our design has to respond to how our world looks and feels. The Haggadah that I've edited, that I've made with Nathan, makes no attempt to redefine what a Haggadah is, or to overlay any particular political or regional agenda. Like all Haggadahs before it, it hopes to inspire radical empathy. And like all Haggadahs before it, it hopes to be replaced. So as the words of our Haggadah are read this Passover, at the very least at our parents' tables, new Haggadahs will be written. And as future Jews at future tables read those Haggadahs, other Haggadahs will be written, and new Haggadahs will be written until there are no more Jews to write them, or until that forever distant day when there are no kinds of slaves anywhere, and there's no more need to say next year in Jerusalem. So now I'll introduce Nathan, who has been, I would say, at my side, or I don't know if I've been at his side, for the last several years working on this. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I'm glad Jonathan finished some sentences because I won't be finishing any. That's not how I talk. What else did I want to say? He talks about being at each other's side. I've been to his house many, many times. He's been to mine many times, and there are no podiums there. The point is this working together is allowed for a lot of things, but it's just quite – there's so many facets to a friendship. I didn't know the one that we'd have working on this book, but I don't get to see him talk that way. It's just lovely to hear Jonathan talk. We usually just giggle. Anyway, but so buttons. This is the he talked about this. Well, this is the tour of vernal equinox for me. I just finished another book tour last night, so it's totally strange to be here tonight. And as Jonathan talked about all the, you know, the cities ahead and first events, I'm wondering. I think I have about four cities till he asks me, "Do you really only have one blazer?" So I'd say around San Francisco, he's going to ask me that. There's so much to say. I kind of just want to answer everything he said because it was making my head spin with nice thoughts and thoughts about the whole project. Even that role of his as editor, we both have a lot of editors in our lives, the good fortune to work with really, honestly, great, great folk. But it's just interesting the demands that this book made of him. I mean, it really is. He listed a lot of scary names. I can't even tell you the book that I just finished touring. I feel like it was written because of this Haggadah. I feel like this project has honestly changed my life, changed the way I think, changed my head. And when you think about that, it's seeing the rules. It's looking at the work that you're doing from a different way. We write all the time. That's all. I think, honestly, I do think it's from a terrible fear of doing honest work and having to get a real job. But, you know, why else do you get it? You know what I'm saying? Sometimes we email, well, it'll be like 4 a.m., 4:10. There's a race to who can write first in the morning. Like, what, are you sleeping until 4:30? Books don't get written starting at 5. That's what I know. But anyway, the idea is just, even that idea of when you're writing a story, it's so clear to me, it's like, in Yan Shel Nizi Rut, it's like an idea, it's monastic in its way. You know, it's not holy work or anything, but exactly, actually to me, it is holy, like it's so deep. That is, I used to be religious fiction, I've transferred all that belief to it. But the one thing you learn, it's very simple aesthetic, it's like the nice guys and gals and third sexed and whatever. But my point is, nice guys don't finish last thing. The rules that you want to be the rules for writing, they're very simple, which is, you know, sit down and work, and your obligation is to the story. That is always your obligation when you're writing, to the story. And I didn't know it would transfer to this. I didn't know those rules. You know, again, those names, you know, Jonathan listed are scary folk. And it's that idea. I feel like you had to make a lot of brave choices. And that idea, you know, all this work, all this stuff, you can't hurt someone's feelings. But in the end, your obligation is to the story. What does the Haggadah need? What does it demand? And I feel like that was, you know, there was some, you know, I've seen it, stunning art. There's my Jonathan joke with him. Everything is illuminated. But the point is, you know, to come down and see that we just need font, we just need text, that's it. Or, you know, if he's going to put the weight on these four beautiful commentaries or the weight that's out on the translation. The point is, when I got started on this, I didn't, you know, back to the Susan Sontag thing, I did not want to do this. You know, not that I was honored to be asked, and I'd already contributed back to those early pieces. I don't even remember what line I wrote about, but I'm sure it was, anyway, a short little essay that was going to get stuck in here. But that, you know, when he came to me with the translation, it was, I just can't commend, like, what a wonderfully bad idea that was. You know, I've never translated anything except I do menu. I can be like, I'll have a Kleine Bier. You know, we booked tour. I can order in any country for you, in Yoli and Brodo. Anyway, but eat my way around the world. I'm going to take my shirt off and show you what that looks like in a minute. Anyway, but I was just really resistant to this for the main reason why I say how the other book was born of this. I've been working on a play the last couple of years and working on the Haggadah at the same time. It's really ideas of identity and ownership and freedom, which is what this book is about. But I'm not a translator. I hadn't been dubbed a translator. Nobody, like, that idea of, you know, being involved with a text like that. And also, I grew up very, very religious, and I am now, I will claim 300% secular. You know, that's a big fight. And my mom and sister just came back from Israel with a pair of mezuzahs that they gave to my girlfriend. You know, we do not have a mezuzah on the door, but I think we are going to just have to break now. My mom's like, the cloth is inside. It's just screw it in. It'll, there's some, one of them has adhesive. You can just stick it. Anyway. But I will talk about that. The point is, I was like, I just wasn't, I was really resistant. It's that idea, you know, when I first gave up religion, you go around breaking every law. It's a matter of tension. If you stretch a rubber band, it's going to snap back. And I was literally going through the Bible just breaking laws, you know. And But, you know, I just, you know, years go by and it's not, you know what I'm saying? I've come here tonight to tell you about my big game in high school. You know, you have to let things go. My point is I'm in a neutral position. It's not an absence. It's not a loss. I'm so thankful for the path of my life. But this idea to live with a text like this was really sort of an overwhelming concept, and I did not think I was the man for the job. And then, you know, Jonathan sent me off. He knows my brain well, really, really well. And, you know, he was really convincing and really clear, and I went off to look at some Haggadot just to open the English side. You know, I grew up back to the Maxwell House. The Maxwell House is really, you know, good in terms of traditional liturgy. That's what I grew up with. But we just did the Hebrew side, and then we ate, you know, we sang the songs, but every word, you know, good, godless, extreme religion, which is, I think, what extreme religion takes that form. God sort of falls out. You know, it's true. When I see, like, people are so deeply religious and they want to, like, declare war on the gays, I'll be like, I honestly think if you're reading the same Bible as me, like, you might want, you know what I'm saying? Like, that ben Adam, ben Makom, the Makom, like this idea, the relationship between man and God and the relationship between man and man. Any Bible, any Quran, take any of those books, I'm pretty sure man and man would come first. I feel like humanity falls out of religion all the time, you know, and it gets into this rote thing. And I was, you know, that's how positive memories of the Seder, but I just done the Hebrew side. And when I opened the English, and the first time, and I looked, I just happened to open to the Havdalah, which we say, you know, every week. And there's a line in it, which is Hamavdil ben Kodesh leKodesh. And I looked at this line, and I thought about this line. And in English, in the one that I opened, it was a really good, hyper-accurate translation, which is, you know, to differentiate between the Sabbath and the holiday. That's what the intent of that line is. Like, Hamavdil ben Kodesh leKodesh, to differentiate, to separate between the Sabbath and the holiday. That's what that line means. That's a great way in English that makes it clear. But then I thought, it says Kodesh leKodesh, like between holy and holy. Like, we have the word in here for Chag, for holiday, for Yom Tov. We have the word Shabbat. When I look at a book and the author has used the word Shabbat, and if we're talking about these texts, most of the author of this book, if you're religious, is God. You know, like, there are other words. I think about word choices all day as a fiction writer, and I thought, wait, we have the word for Shabbat. We have the word for holiday. It says, Kilo, Amavdil ben Kodesh leKodesh, to separate between the holy and holy. And I thought, who has made this decision, like, that what is the space? I know the space. It's clear. It answers. This is a book about discussion, and there's no discussion about the space between Sabbath and holiday. We know what that is. It's just clear. This is that time we're going to differentiate between these two things. But then I thought about what is the space between holy and holy? It's metaphysical. It's gigantic or tiny. You know what I'm saying? You could talk about that for 900 hours, and it's so deep and so gigantic and such a large thing. And even back to the idea of rhythm, you know, ben kodesh leKodesh, like between Sabbath, you know, there's a rhythm there. There's a holy and holy, like maybe it goes softer in the English, but you owe that rhythm. It's the first time I understood it. Jonathan and I were talking about this. We've talked about all of this. I can't wait for the Q&A. It's going to be like stump the band. There's not a word in this book that we have not argued, I promise you. And I also, this is my first time to publicly thank Jonathan for chasing out words like zenithalis. I thought so hard that I started making up my own words. I'm like, Jonathan, the English language has been exhausted, and I've had to, and he's like, really, please, I promise you, those changes make all the difference. But anyway, I just thought about ownership. It's a lesson I learned when I was living in Jerusalem, which I did for many years when I lived right across from the Knesset in this crazy little neighborhood. And, you know, in America, Jonathan lived in D.C., maybe it feels different there, but even there, like, you don't see the president, like, at Quiznos. You know, like, that's, you know, in Jerusalem, it was the first time I understood that people run the world. Like, people run for office, and then I always thought there was a bigger plan. And, you know, even if you believe that, like, you know, if you're religious, you believe, like, Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God in heaven, told the Bible word for word to Moses at, you know, Sinai. Like, if this is your belief, that's fine. But nobody thinks God did the Italian translation. You know, like, nobody, it's, you know what I'm saying? It's not the King James, but it's not, and I really, it was an idea of, and that was a thing, I honestly, that's why I say why I think it changed my writing, why the book I've just written, most of it took me a year, it would have taken me 20, because it was different ideas of ownership and identity. I understood, you know, you could sit with one word of this forever, you know, I would just, and that's maybe the story, you know, that's sort of what happened. I thought this was going to be a hipster Haggadah, and, you know, like, back to that, honestly, back to that thing, I thought I was going to riff. I mean, that's what we were building. I thought it was going to be, you know, respectful, but really freestyle and all these voices. And then when I thought about it, you know, and this is, I also get really sensitive when, religion claims morality. It's really strange for me. We can do it here on a screen and stack the bodies from, you know, secular conflict and religious. I'm sure they would stack equally. I don't know who would win the horrible, you know what I'm saying? There's no ownership of morality or violence or that's, but this idea that a secular morality is any less of a morality is a really strange concept to me that I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is why I'm talking about it now. But anyway, as I got working on this, I also forgot, which is why, back to Jonathan's wonderful explanation of everything, nobody lets me explain, like, at our poker game, not allowed to talk, because I always think everything that's in my head is in everybody else's head. I do. I have no idea, so it didn't even cross my mind. If I know this, like, you know, sort of when Jonathan came to me, like, why would you come to me as a translator? It didn't cross my mind that everyone maybe doesn't, like, have a working Aramaic, you know? But that idea, when I started to think about this, that probably I can't even imagine the percentage of people that are going to be using, religious people who are going to be using the English side, you know, to pray to God, you know, to remember Exodus. And that's when it turned from 6 weeks into 3 years, where I understood there was a great moral responsibility for this. Like, it's somebody is going to be, like, it doesn't matter what I think or if I believe in God or don't believe in God or pray or don't pray, but that someone's going to use the words to bless God that I have to commit to. Again, just doing an honor to that text. That was just such a gigantic thing. And I'd roughed it out. And this, I do want to thank Baruch up here, Baruch Thaler, who I worked with and then worked with Jonathan. But this guy, after my first book, when I don't know, those of you who are old enough, ask your parents when you get home about my first book. But it's many years ago. But I used to look like a young woman. I had long, but anyways, I had very long hair and I was recognizable. And people used to come up to me often and say, I was religious. You know, they'd say, I once had matzah or I saw yentl at a friend's. You know, this was, and I'd say, that's very good. But anyway, but once this guy came up to me looking leather pants, you know, like really looking like a sort of a kind of toasted kind of hippie, came up to me and said, oh, you're that guy with that book. I want to talk to you about this story, you know, and unlike I said, you know, our friends that are actors in New York and directors, like they'll be like, you know, if you're having dinner, they have to protect their privacy. As a writer, if you recognize me, I'm like, can I buy you a coffee? I will invite anyone to sit down. It's a great thing. You get real points. But this guy started talking to me, and I recognized I was talking to one of the great minds that I'd ever, honestly, like a gadol hador. I was like, this man is a genius. This is, you know, 10 years ago or something. And he left, and he was just literary and had every kind of reference. Like, he was artsy and literary, and then just had this. Now, it was just shocking to me. Point is, I had roughed out this translation, and then I'd felt this responsibility, and I thought, you know, a traditional text should be done in a traditional form, which is the way I grew up studying in Chavruta, the word chaver, you see the root, but it's face-to-face, head-to-head. You know what I'm saying? That's how you really learn Torah. That's how you do a Jewish text. And then this guy, literally, I think I basically had the rough draft of this translation, and he walked into my coffee shop. I hadn't seen him in years. And I said, you know, I have been waiting for you. And I asked him to study, and maybe I'll end all these stories here and read you something. I just want you to hear the text, and then we'll take questions. But we just studied. We went back to primary sources, and just that's part of how the liturgy got built, is this idea, you know, we really wanted a Haggadah that everyone can use. I was thinking about that. I was deep into the translation that would have worked really well for conservative Jews and reformed Jews, and this is about religious tolerance. I hate tolerance. Don't tolerate me. Respect me. I'll respect you. But that idea, you know, something when you feel as we, don't make me start on Santorum. But anyway, But this idea, you know, as Jonathan said, exactly, my mom already sent my sister 15 copies, like, the families better have this Haggadah this year. And I thought about that. My family that's deeply religious, that's respectful of my life, and I thought, am I going to spend years on this project and my sister won't be able to use it at her table? It really needed to be for all Jews. So anyway, Baruch and I mean, with just hundreds of hours sitting there, like Talmuds and Gemaras and, you know, different, you know, Tanakh, just piles of books, which then my girlfriend would come home and say, I'm living in a, still we can't have a mezuzah, she would say. I'm living in a study hall. I'm like, we're secular. I'm just going to learn Torah for 20 hours a day. Anyway, I'm going to read you one part because I really just think you should hear what it sounds like. And another nice thing that Jonathan said, and of Jonathan's lovely ideas that he fought for was the sliding band, is really that this is, you know, it's a different sense. That's, he said it before, I was going to say it already when I got up here, but he promised me, like, we will be proud of this. And it's so, I would never, you know, hold up my collection and be like, this is all, you know, it's not the, I don't even finish the word, you see, it's not appropriate. It's not even if you, it's, you wouldn't even want to in your head. It's not respectful to your own work to be that way. But to be involved in a project where we're trying to do honor, like, that's the whole thing. You know, like the band with our names, I thought that was so brilliant and touching on John's part that it should fall away. Like, this is not ours. It's everyone's book. And that idea, I can't even tell you how this translation back to ownership, you know, what translating is taking ownership of these words. But I just wanted people to hear what I hear in my head in Hebrew, but not about me. My point is, what I'm going to read to you is, if you think it's beautiful, it's because the Hebrew is so beautiful. It's and this is not just in the Haggadah. Hallel gets it a lot of times a year. It's Nishmat Kol Chai, and it's considered a very, very beautiful text in Hebrew. But I just want to read you a couple of pages, and then we'll take us some questions. Let the spirit of all life bless your name, Lord God of us, and the breath of all flesh glorify and extol our remembrance of you, our eternal King. From infinity and to infinity, you are God. And without you, we have no king to redeem and deliver, to ransom and rescue, to provide and be compassionate through every period of difficulty and distress. We have no king but you, God of the first and the last, God of all creations, master of all generations, who is praised with an abundance of veneration, who pilots his world with beneficence and his creations with compassion. And the Lord does not drowse and does not sleep. He is the one who wakes sleepers and rouses those under the spell of slumber, who gives voice to the mute and unbinds the bound, embraces the falling and straightens the bent. It is to you alone, that we are thankful. Were it our mouths were filled with a singing like the sea, and our tongues awash with song as waves countless, and our lips lauding as the skies are wide, and our eyes illumine like the sun and the moon, and our hands spread out like the eagles of heavens, and our feet as fleet as fawns, still we would not suffice in thanking you, Lord God of us and God of our thousands, in blessing your name for even one of a thousand thousand from the thousands of thousands and the ten thousands of ten thousands of times you did good turns for our fathers and for us. From Egypt you delivered us, Lord God of us, and from the house of servitude you ransomed us. In hunger you nourished, in plenty you provided, from the sword you rescued, from pestilence you let us slip away, and from disease, evil, and enduring you drew us. Until this point we were aided by your compassion, your loving kindness never left us, and do not abandon us, Lord God of us, for eternity. And so the limbs that you apportioned us, and the spirit and the soul that you breathed into our nostrils, and the tongue that you placed in our mouths, they will thank you, and they will bless you, and they will laud you, and they will glorify you, and they will extol you, and they will revere you, and they will sanctify you, and they will make sovereign your name, our King. Because every mouth to you will thank, and every tongue to you will pledge, and every knee to you will kneel, and all who stand to you will bow flat out, and all our hearts will be in awe of you, and every belly and its innards will sing your name. As it is written, all of my bones will exclaim, Lord, who is like you, who rescues the poor man from the one more powerful, and the poor and pauper from the one who preys upon them? Who could compare to you, and who could be equal to you, and who could measure to you in value the God monumental, the mighty and awesome, God supreme, proprietor of the heavens and the earth? We will praise you, and we will laud you, and we will glorify you, and we will bless your holy name, as it is said by David, my soul doth bless the Lord, and all I contain blesses his holy name. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Andy. I'm director of author events, and the way this works is you raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Perhaps I can start off the game of Stump the Tzaddik with a question about the the translation, Nathan, and that would be, I read the book cover to cover, and I was curious, and it's the first time I've ever read a Haggadah cover to cover. I was curious about, there are sections in the book where there are alternate translations, and can you talk about why that is?
Yeah, that's a great, it's Davar Acher, like another thing, basically. But, some of the Davar Achers, it gets back to ownership. You know, I've learned so many facts from Jonathan, but thinking of it, and also he's made me see it as a living document. I think, there's not a lot of Torahs running around where you're like, oh, yours has Genesis after Exodus, mine's the other. You know what I'm saying? There was one Torah, there's one, I guess it's Purim to Passover tonight, I guess, for those who've been. Anyway, but like there's one Megillat Esther, there's one of all these books. Jews don't usually give much leeway on that front. Like, this is a really living text, you know. I sometimes think about it with, like, Sephardim and Ashkenazi, like, that, you know, Jews of Oriental lands pray one way and, you know, Galician Jews another. But there's so many, like, traditional, there's just choices to be made. And when I saw that the Davar Acher, as, you know, we were all, you know, building this liturgy and looking at stuff, you'd come upon beautiful things that were, you know, so there were some alternate things in the most standard Haggadah, and then we thought somebody, you know, just because that's the idea of connecting through time and space. Wait a second, you know, like, oh, 700 years ago, somebody was making this Haggadah and said, oh, and another thing should go in here, Davar Acher, and stuck it in, you know, because it was beautiful. So in looking through all these beautiful liturgies, something from here, you know, these alternate readings, I just didn't, you know, back to John, back to these rules about fiction, like I deeply believe, you know, it's first, you maybe dream of having a writing life and dream of getting to write a book, but it's this idea, like a novel, it shouldn't be like, I always say, like, you know, milk. Like, if you leave it out on the table, it's going to spoil. You want to be able to pick up a novel, you know, in a 100 years. And I didn't want to say, like, it's very weird to be in time, even choices of, like, masculine and feminine. It should be outside of time. It should live through time, whether, as Jonathan said, it'll get replaced. But really, this idea, I didn't want it to be like, I'm going to put in, you know, this is, you know, oh, I'm going to put in something about, you know, the organic apples in Whole Foods. You know, like, you know, saying that people, and that's beautiful when people add all those pages for What's Up Time, but I thought the conversation is with these texts, and in a sense, the ideas being raised or the thoughts are that, in a sense, to me, is the other material in this book, which is other materials from other Haggadot that continue, you know, this conversation over millennia.
Thank you. To continue the conversation, gentlemen in the blue and fourth row.
In your researches, did you find anything connecting Kafka to the Haggadah? And also, in your initial list, did you ask Philip Roth to contribute?
It sounds like the first question you asked sounds like a question of somebody who knows the answer before asking the question. I never came across anything with Kafka and Haggadah, though maybe it's not to say it doesn't exist. It just didn't cross my field of vision.
I thought of it because Nathan reminded me of Kafka.
we're both old.
Philip Roth, no, I didn't write to him.
The chopped liver comes before the Passover Seder. Lady about five rows back.
Jonathan, I actually heard you speak 6 years ago when Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close came out, and you spoke here, and you were phenomenal then, you're phenomenal now, and I'm just so impressed by the two of you. But how do you two know each other, and now do you ever have a conversation that does not involve the Haggadah?
I know Nathan through his first book. I was in college, I guess I don't remember what year I was, but I was in college, and somebody, a good friend, said, oh, you should, I've heard a lot of good things about this book, you should get this book. I remember very well walking across the street to the bookstore, it was a beautiful day, bringing it back, sitting on the grass like you do in college, and reading a book. And I remember reading the author bio, and something about the whole thing really appealed to me. This was before I had even gotten into the stories, but it was like a young Jewish man who was giving a, what it was basically living the life I wanted to live. And then when reading the book, I felt that much more strongly. So we didn't meet until years after that. I found my literary agent because my mother said, you should call the person that represents Nathan Englander because he's had such a great run. And you thanked her in your book, I guess.
Yes.
And so I, you know, one thing led to another, and then we got to know each other. As far as talking about this, no. I think we never talk about it except for when we're working on it.
Yeah, I was going to. And same, see, that's, it's funny because I always think where it's like, because the same thing, all the, I did not know, but I, you know, fell in love. I read Everything is Illuminated in manuscript. And that's, you know, sometimes I think when you're advocating, people think you're advocating for your friends, but I think I do advocate for all my friends. I would do, they can have, does anyone, if they're here, I will give a kidney. I know Susie's here. I'll give her my kidney right now. But my point is, she's Susan now. We're adults. Anyway, but my point is, when you're writer friends, like, there's a reason you're writer friends. There's also that thing of, like, where you can communicate about, you know what I'm saying, where I just fell in love with that book, and that's what, you know, it's that it's not actually you're gunning for your friends because they're your friends. It's because you believe in their work. It makes, you know, such a really nice thing. And it's funny us having the same agent, because every once in a while, my mom will ask for something. She'll be like, the only other mother I have to do that for is Jonathan's mother. You know, the two Jewish mothers. Anyway, but the point is, I was going to say, as I said tonight, it's just so lovely to hear him speak this way. You know what I'm saying? I know he's a brilliant man, and I see that in our friendship. But we almost never talk shop, and I don't think with a lot of my other writer friends. I think you talk about anything else but that. You know, often the anxiety around it, it's often like active therapy. Therapeutic side, yes, but work, no.
In the second row here.
Both of you talked about how you're, you know, 200 and 300% secular, respectively. But
no, so I actually did not say that.
Was Susan something.
I was quoting somebody. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I lied. He did, anyways.
He's like 38%.
When you're working on the book, do you ever feel kind of guilty for being this self? Not the book. The version. Do you ever feel guilty for being this self-acknowledged secular Jew?
You know,
I mean, I just don't believe Nathan when he describes himself that way. It's just not true. I mean, I'm willing to believe that this is not really an argument to be had. I mean, this is what I think about this conversation generally, is it's just a problem of definitions. Like, my little brother has the smartest answer I've ever heard to, do you believe in God? He says, I'm agnostic about the answer, and I'm agnostic about the question. Like, it's very hard to believe we're talking about the same things. And when you say that you're secular, I know that obviously you believe what you're saying, but that's, according to a very specific definition that you walk around with. A lot of people would look at Nathan and say, he spent 3 years working on, you know, a ritualistic text. The passage he just read out loud, that he was obviously proud of because he chose to read it, is basically just an extended praise of the Almighty. So what do we mean when we talk about, you know, being secular or being religious? What do we mean when we talk about belief? You know, there might be an analogy, actually, in the story of the Exodus itself. You know, there's some contention amongst some community about whether or not it happened. You know, what is the proof that any of this actually happened? And the way I think about it is, the proof is that more than 100 generations have been telling the story. Does it mean that there were large numbers of Jews who fled Pharaoh in a given finite period of time and that a sea parted? It means that the story is incredibly valuable, and the story is very significant. It stood the test of time by people like Susan Sontag, you know, who refer to Passover as Pesach. So what interests me is not necessarily the stories we tell about ourselves, but the stories we tell, you know. And you devoted a huge portion of your life to telling this story.
Should I address it? I feel guilty all the time. That's the truth. But I did not feel guilty about that. There's one thing I don't feel guilty about is writing. You know, and maybe I was going to say, Jonathan's calling me out. It's a good way to call me out. I think you know, getting back to translation, you can also translate English. You know, I was thinking about, that's what I've been talking about, like, if you had to translate water, you know, that's what this felt like for me, words that are just so close to, that don't, they already have the meaning. I think things that lose their meaning, you know, like friendly fire, I think of as an example, where things lose, we say that so much that they lose the horribleness of what they are. But, yeah, I think it's that idea, because I have issues, you know, because religion's not just religion, it's politics, and it's power, and it's all these things, and that's, you know, and I don't, so maybe that's it, maybe I'm very religious, but I honestly, it's weird that we give, you know, I see, again, so much fucking Bible waving now, and the sprouting of nonsense, where I'm like, have you read the book that you're claiming says the thing that's, you know, in it? So, yeah, I guess I can't even, having, I have, you know, like, from, that's, oh, The Frisco Kid. That was an awesome movie. I have read this book, and I did not understand a word. But yeah, I just can't conceive of a God that would be mad at all the wrong things. So maybe I am deeply religious, but the God that is, you know, again, being used for organized religion in this country in those ways, just can't, yeah, I can't hold that in my head. But I, my point is, I'm religious about books. I love texts.
Some more questions. Lady in red in the middle here.
Jonathan, you mentioned at the very beginning that you consider this a radical book, which I would agree with.
I'm not sure I said that, actually. I think I said Nathan's... I think it's a book that asks for a radical leap of empathy. That was what
okay.
I had said.
All right. So my question, I guess, to both of you is, what has to happen at your family seders this year using this Haggadah that will make you feel successful?
I mean, I don't expect that it will all happen this year. You know, it's like a process. You know, you get used to each other. You get used to the conversation. You get used to the book. You find ways of making it more a more useful fit for your family. So there's no litmus test. You know, I hope that... You know, I hope, first of all, that more people at the table feel more included and feel like they are participants in something rather than recipients of something. And I hope that, you know, Haggadahs traditionally beg to be skimmed. And I hope that this one begs to be lingered upon. You know, that, and I think you'll just sense that from, you know, the way people look at the pages, the way that, you know, not an eagerness to go from page 27 to page 48, but to like, let's just hold on 1 second. That was a kind of interesting thing. Did we? Are we sure we exhausted that? That would be my idea of success.
And I actually, I guess I, it's interesting test kitchens that I feel like we've run. It's you know, even last year I was, you know, one of the seders I ended up at, and again, none of us religious unless we are. But but that idea, you know, people have been asked, I feel like friends have been stealing pages, and Jonathan's been leaking, like around Passover, we've been getting bugged for years, and even then someone's like, oh, how's that, you know, a cousin was like, how's that Haggadah? And, you know, I had it on in our world, I was like, oh, I got some new pages from Jonathan. We all took out our iPhones, and I circulated the PDFs, but it was just interesting for me, because that was like, a cousin asking because he's interested personally in my translation. And within minutes, somebody was, you know, the timeline suddenly took over on the top of the pages. And it was really interesting for me to see, you know, exactly, you know, what Jonathan had envisioned getting put in play, which is you're trying to move ahead. And, you know, it's a book, again, in our fiction, I think we try really hard not to have people stuck. I think this is a book of stuckiness, but that's it. We, you know, just with those few pages, we were off and running in all kinds of directions. So I feel like I've already seen just a different kind of experience on my end.
Why don't we take a few more questions? All the way back on the left there, about 8 rows. On your left, Carol. Sorry.
Not you. Definitely not you.
Hi, you alluded to this briefly, but you also said that you really examined every single word. And so I can imagine that you must have had a very rigorous conversation about the gender issue for God, and I was very curious to get some insight on what the nature of that conversation was and how you came to the conclusion.
Sure, Jen, yeah, I mean, my point is that from the beginning is something I thought about deeply and argued with Barak and argued with Jonathan. You know, Yes, there is nothing that wasn't neuroticized and sat over. And but you know what? I'll answer, but I'm dying to also hear what John had to say about that. But for me, you know what? Like, obligation is to text. So that idea sometimes where it says sons of Israel, like some cases I said children of Israel, like you can make it gender or neutral in places, but this is the text. Like I don't, you know what I'm saying? We can't make the, you know, just this idea that it's the male form of God. This is the male. I just think we can make that. That's not, I really thought obligation to text and that I would respect the reader, that we can make that leap. If you know what I'm saying? If that's the idea, if you're as was in my house, where we all sat on our fat asses and the women slaved and sweated and worked, you know what I'm saying, to the bone, like, you know, then you need a gender neutral. Like, this idea, that's not the battle being fought here. You know, we need, again, I can't be, you know, any more, you know, I am strong on those fronts. But the point is, you know, I just think the text is the text, and it's not for me to edit for now or change it and just say, oh, this is the proper nod for now. That's how my head works. I don't see that as a male. I don't do not, you know, turn it into a male God in that way. So again, back to a meaning in your head. What do you see in my head? I don't see it as, you know, just this super male dominated thing. And it's only the sons who went down and there weren't women there. When it says, you know, the sons, I picture all of Israel. That's the way people spoke then. This is the text that we're dealing with. And I felt like, again, everything's going to crumble unless the whole obligation is to the text.
What version of the text did you use for the translation?
No, every version. There's actually, I have to look it up, but it's awesome. One of the things that was, you're like, awesomely boring to us, but interesting to me. But you know, the idea, one thing that I said over for a long time, it's like a hand wide open, and it's all these hand things where it's like generous, but it's like a hand open, broad, flat, wide, generous. And it, like, there, it's one letter change, and I was like, do I go with the set? Clearly it's a 700-year-old typo. You know what I'm saying? Because the other letter would be another thing for an open hand. You know, it was yet, there's like four synonyms about an open hand, and then the fifth one says, like, happy, you know, and I was like, wow, you know, that, see, those were the decisions about loyalty to the timeline where I'm like, I thought if a typo has stood, it's clearly a typo, it would be a fifth openness, and it's one letter that would easily change, got changed, but yeah, those were decisions where I think I went with the typo, because if it's been absorbed, back to tradition, if it's been a typo for, it's a typo no more. Anyway, but I'd love to hear, that was not very eloquent, but impassioned, I'd love to hear your gender.
I think there are two things at stake. One is, what, you know, with every decision, what do you gain and what do you lose? And to what extent is it a distraction? I think, as Nathan was saying, in cases where it's not a distraction, there can be every reason to make it egalitarian. But, you know, to say, you know, the four children instead of the four sons or the four sons and daughters, I think it's a distraction. And more importantly, the second thing is, what do you assume of the users? Like, are we going to assume, like, what level of intelligence and engagement do you assume? Do I assume that, you know, the reader is somebody who will interpret this as a misogynistic text? Or do I assume the reader is someone who contextualizes it in history and appreciates it for the questions it's begging, rather than the ones that it accidentally or incidentally raises? And I think we, you know, assumed a very high level of intelligence, and to me, it actually made a lot of decisions less relevant than if it had been a Haggadah written for children, for example.
Let's leave it at a high level of intelligence. Jonathan Safran Foer, Nathan Englander.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.